Hello, I'm Penina from Circle Care Services, and welcome to My BCBA Life. Circle Care Services is an ABA therapy agency, and we're all about giving BCBAs the support and community you're looking for. With this podcast, you're not on your own anymore. You're part of a BCBA community committed to making this world a better place to BCBA. Once this episode is complete, you'll be able to obtain a free CEU certificate for the clinical topic discussed. You'll need to confirm your attendance by taking note of the three surprise words I will drop throughout this episode. There is a link in the show notes below of a form that will ask you for your information and the surprise words that we need to generate your CEU certificate. Thank you, and let's get started. Welcome, Tricia, to My BCBA Life. Super excited to have you here. If you can start just by sharing with the audience who you are, what you're currently doing as a BCBA now, I'd appreciate it.
Yeah. So my name's Patricia Lund. I go by Tricia, and I am a BCBA and a certified special education teacher and a certified sexuality educator and a certified trauma professional. I started off teaching special education in schools. I did high school and junior high, and then I worked briefly in a clinic, and then I'm doing what I do now, which is working with teens and adults that are getting services through Medicaid waiver programs. So a lot of them are in group homes, day habs, state facilities, and stuff like that.
Amazing. So you are a BCBA and a lot of other things. I'm just curious, what made you go into, I'm saying you started off as special ed, it sounds like, and then you became a BCBA, and then you certified in many different areas. So what prompted you to do that?
Part of the honest answer is imposter syndrome.
Okay.
Let's just be real about that. Sometimes I get the feeling I don't know enough, and my brain tells me, if you get more letters, then you'll know more, people will respect you more. So that is a part I'm not proud of, but it's an honest piece.
Okay.
And then when I started working with adults, I realized that there was so much that I didn't know that I wasn't taught in my ABA classes. So many of my clients have experienced trauma or having issues with dating or wanting to get married or maybe even having some inappropriate sexual behaviors. And so I thought, well, I don't have the knowledge for this. And so I want to make sure that I'm getting I guess the right experience to do things ethically.
That's amazing. I once heard something like, the more you know, the more you realize you don't know. So
I know, I guess, right?
That's really what it is. It's you start, the more you they're like, oh, wait, there's more to that. Oh, gosh. And then you just realize the more you know, the more there's out there that you don't know. And it's a good thing to be a truth seeker and always just to want to hear and know more. So I would never hold that against you, even if it's prompted by imposter syndrome. It's a good thing. So I guess nailing into your specialty, I think specifically the trauma aspect that you are certified in, that it's something that is, you know, that could talk to many BCBAs. So I guess let's just go into the very basics of trauma-informed therapy when it comes to ABA. How would you explain what trauma-informed therapy is?
Yeah. So, and I guess before we start that, I want to just mention like three people that have really helped me understand trauma. Because while I say I'm a certified trauma professional, to me, that just means I have some education about what trauma does to a nervous system. You know, it does not qualify me to be a talk therapist in any way. And I also feel like even with that certification, you still need to make sure that you are getting supervision and keeping updated on the new stuff, because it's a new area, trauma and ABA. So just quickly, so Gabby Morgan, Camille Kolu, and Megan DeLeon Miller are ones that, you know, if anyone is interested in ABA and trauma, I would look at those three people and, you know, what they've done in their CEUs, because it's amazing.
Okay, that's very helpful. Thank you.
Yeah. So when it comes to what I feel trauma-informed ABA is, I think it's us recognizing how trauma impacts someone's behavior and their development and their emotional responses to things. Especially when I'm writing my behavior plan, sometimes I think of trauma as almost a setting event that is going to predispose someone to, not predispose, but is going to make someone like act in a certain way. And I think a big piece with trauma is trauma lives in the nervous system. You know, when we're traumatized by something, it makes our nervous system get stuck in this fight or flight mode. And so a lot of, I think, what it means to be trauma-informed is to understand the nervous system and how trauma impacts that nervous system and how behaviors are happening because the nervous system is so dysregulated.
You're talking about a lot of the education piece, so if you could go, I guess, more into specific what it is. You said it in very clear, broad term. It's bring them to a fight or flight by you're kind of said that if a person is going to act because of trauma, they don't really have a choice in the matter of acting differently because it's kind of setting them on, it's triggering them to do something that is just, yeah. You know. So I'm curious, like, I guess, how would that come up in a session or how could I identify that as such?
Yeah. So for someone that has been through trauma, we have some different trauma responses or stress responses. And the ones that people know most are the fight, flight, freeze. But there's more. You can also have a fawn response, which is being overly nice, overly kind. Yes, I'll do what you want. You know, anything to make you not get upset. Fight, flight, freeze, fawn, flooding. And so that's where you have lots of really big feelings that just kind of like flood your whole system. And so I think it's really important to know about those responses because then that can help us know why someone's having a behavior. So for instance, I had a client who had some trauma around a dog. I don't know exactly what the trauma was because she wasn't able to verbalize that. But we did know there's a trauma that happened with the dog. And so every time she heard a dog barking, it triggered a memory of the trauma, which caused her nervous system to just go into this freeze response. And she wouldn't move. She wasn't even like looking at me. She was like looking off in the distance, which is also a trauma thing. Like if you look at like evolution, when we were out, you know, in the jungle and trying to get food and all this, we needed to be aware of what was going on. And so our ears were very focused on outside, very distal sounds. And so for her, that's what she was focused on because she was trying to find the threat. And so she wasn't attending to me or what I was saying. And so once we knew that she's not just being non-compliant, quote unquote, she's not trying to, you know, make staff upset. She's having a trauma response to the sound of the dog. Then we're able to figure out how to change the environment, how to help her engage in emotional regulation skills to bring back feelings of safety in that moment.
That explains a lot. Thank you. I guess take us back a little bit because trauma-informed therapy is a new thing, but is that why you think it's more prevalent in the ABA space because it's becoming more prevalent everywhere, or you think something specifically brought it into the ABA space?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. So I go back to, and I think, well, so I don't know who started this, but I first learned about it with Megan DeLeon when she was talking to autistic adults about their experience with ABA. And she found that there were many people that had very negative experiences with ABA and sometimes had trauma from that. And I remember hearing her talk about that, and it was like this eye-opening thing that I could have potentially been doing things that were causing some trauma. And so I really credit her to kind of bringing that into the forefront so we can kind of really look at, well, what are the interventions that I'm doing and am I causing harm? Even if it's unintentional, right? It's still harm. But I also think in general, the world is moving more towards being more open about mental health in general. And so I do think that that also plays a big part.
For sure. Now, I guess taking it to a more practical level for a minute, trauma-informed is huge. Like you said, if you weren't helping that client with the knowledge that she's traumatized from a dog, I don't know what kind of interventions you would have done, but none of it would have been beneficial. And if anything, it would have been harmful. So it is super important to be trauma-informed and to know and to understand and to look out for it. So I guess how to practically implement, how can I practice ABA while being trauma-informed? What do you think is an important piece to that?
Yeah. First, I think a lot of it is about asking the questions so you can already kind of get a history. And, you know, maybe if the child is little, that might be a little bit different, or it might be harder if they can't always verbalize. But I know that when I'm doing my assessments, I have a whole trauma-informed piece. And I don't always ask, you know, because if you're starting with an assessment, you're like, tell me about your trauma. Like, that's also not trauma-informed, right? But sometimes they're forthright with it. And so I think that's a big part, is initially being aware of, hey, what were past traumas? That way I can already know them in my head as I'm doing some programming. I also think a big part of it is building rapport. And I think there's a difference between pairing yourself with a client and building rapport and a feeling of safety with a client.
That's the first time I've heard something like that. So please talk about that a little bit more.
Yeah, and I feel like there might be people that disagree with me, especially in some of these clinics that are really changing how they do things. But in my mind, pairing is you find out what is reinforcing for the child so that you can turn into that fun thing, and then we can use that to later get you to, you know, learn new skills or maybe be more compliant with things that I want you to do. In my mind, building rapport means I'm honoring you. I'm honoring where you're at. I'm honoring your feelings. I'm offering choices. And I'm going to show you that I'm a safe person, that I'm a safe person. Even if you are getting upset and yelling and screaming at me, I'm a safe person for you to be with. Does that make sense?
Yes. Love it. I think people associate pairing as, you split it into two. I would think most people go into pairing with building that relationship as a safety net. Like, when I come, it's a good thing. You want to work with me. And then part of it is also learning the client and their clinical end of what's reinforcing and all that. But it's interesting, like, it is two separate pieces and both are very important. And probably the rapport is more important than the pairing in the way you said it.
Yeah, and at least I've noticed that with my adult clients, is that it takes, building that rapport is huge, and it takes a while to build that rapport. And because a lot of them, and because I work with adults, they could care less if I give them a skill. That means nothing. You know, in fact, it can feel demeaning, you know, when I find out what's reinforcing and I withhold the reinforcement until they do a thing. And so I think, at least for my adult clients, building that rapport, I find it goes a longer way.
Mm-hmm. So by building the rapport, do you feel like they'll open up with you about, and
yes,
you'll also probably get to just know them more. The more you know them, the more you know, like, okay, this is a basic response, or this is I never saw this response from this client. Let me look into it and see what was the environmental factors that could have triggered this. Is there, like, could there have been a traumatic option?
Yeah. Yeah.
My first surprise word is note.
Yeah. Well, and I think it's important to note too that trauma is it's not the event that's traumatic, it's how we respond to an event that's traumatic. Two people can go through the same event, and one person is going to walk away and no big deal, but the other person is going to have some really difficult, you know, feelings and symptoms around that. And this is something I've had to talk to a lot, especially with some of my group home staff, is because I've had some of my staff say, well, that's not traumatizing, or I don't understand why they're upset about this. To you, that thing may not have been traumatizing, but for them, it is traumatizing. And so, you know, I think just being aware that, you know, we may hear people talk about trauma and maybe our first response is, well, it wasn't a big deal. But for whatever reason, for their body, it felt like a big deal.
I just want to give an example on that because it's so true. I was like, you see it with little kids, and if a kid has an overreaction to something that's like, forget about traumatic, it's something small, you know how the mom reacts in the house when something like that happens, and that's kind of what builds, like, the emotion builds up. Like, when something spills, something as small as that, you know, like, it's a very basic scenario that happens all the time. And if the adult or the person that the child looks up to in the home freaks out from a spill that could really just be cleaned up, then it's just the child, every time a spill happens, it's going to be like, not, I wouldn't say a traumatic experience, but it's going to be like an experience, like, you know, as opposed to where a spill, it's like, oh, okay, let's clean it up. And then it like it doesn't even register in the child's home. And I see it so many times with different kids. Like, unfortunately, where like the a small spill is the end of the world. I personally work on this. I have a 2-year-old, and every time I spill something, I say, "That's okay. Let's clean it up." And he spilled something, and he does not like being dirty. It freaks him out. It spilled, and I saw him give a face response, and then he looked at me and said, "It's okay. Let's clean it up." Like he's, you know, that's really the response. Really does make a difference. And even if, I guess, the way you see other people respond will tell you, "Oh, that's a dangerous situation." Because she responded like that, I have to like react as such.
Yeah, it's a really good point. I think it speaks to like the nervous system. And, you know, maybe we were already heightened because we were engaging in fun things, or maybe something just made us nervous. You know, it doesn't have to be trauma. It can be just a stress response because your body is really dysregulated. And then something small happens and it causes a big behavior. And I mean, I remember when I was first starting out and I would do the activities where we would sort, you know, a big problem versus a little problem and a big reaction versus a little reaction. And I stopped that because in my mind, it wasn't trauma informed, because there may be little things for you that feel really big. And so there's not really, you know, a correct way to sort those. And it's also going to depend on, you know, what's been going on. And so I kind of had to stop those things because I didn't feel like, at least for me, it didn't feel trauma informed.
Very interesting. I guess what if you would do that? I'm just curious, Ruthi. What if you would do that? You wouldn't sort big problems or little problems, but they are, just so that you can be more in the know of what's big for them. Like you don't have any say in it.
Yeah. Yeah. Like kind of knowing what their triggers are. Yeah. Like, and I think I would add like some psychoeducation piece to that and say, yeah. And sometimes the size can also change. You know, something might feel really big right now, but tomorrow it may not. And this is where I use a lot of like acceptance and commitment therapy techniques to, you know, talk about just that fluidity. Because I think you're right. Like maybe being able to sort those is something that can help us identify like what triggers are, and maybe also acknowledging that flexibility. Today, this feels like a big day, but tomorrow it may not feel like a big day or like a big deal.
Right. I guess also, you know, like if you're very well rested one day, you'll have more energy to deal with something as opposed to a day that you're tired. The smallest thing is the biggest thing. And it is. It is the biggest thing because you're very tired. So then it's just, you know, so it is. That's a good point. And you mentioned psychoeducation. So I want to go into that because psychoeducation is a huge piece. I guess tell us why it's so important.
Yeah, I feel like when I say psychoeducation, to me, that means teaching someone about their body and about how their body is working and about how their nervous system works or how their brain works. I feel like psychoeducation can go a long way because it normalizes things. So, you know, if I have a client that comes to me and they're talking about how they had, you know, they got physically aggressive with the staff because they, they were remembering an event or they had just seen their mom and their mom had yelled at them. What I do is I explain, hey, it sounds like your body was doing some things to keep yourself safe. Your body felt like it wasn't safe. So your body is actually having a normal response to feelings of unsafety. And then we can take away some of the blame, because when we add blame and shame, well, why did you do this? Why did you do that? That's going to cause them to be even more dysregulated. And so I feel like that psychoeducation piece can provide a lot of normalization. Oh, yeah, everyone's body does these things. I'm not the only body that does this or the body that has big reactions. I think, and I've done this with some of my clients too, but some psychoeducation around the brain. And we try to simplify it a lot, but we talk about how the front of your brain, that prefrontal cortex, is what helps you make decisions, weigh pros and cons, not react quickly, prioritize, all that stuff. But when we're super stressed, that front part of our brain stops working. And so we talk about different strategies that are going to get your prefrontal cortex engaged again, and then we can start problem solving and like making choices. But we talk a lot about how until your body is calm, your brain can't calm down. So let's calm our body so our brain can calm, and then we can problem solve or figure out what we need to do to fix a situation.
So you would say for a client that's an adult, or for a client, I guess, explaining it in younger terms and to the parents, probably critical also, a big piece. the psychoeducation is a prerequisite to being able to deal with any sort of trauma or
triggered response.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
What? It sounds pretty, you know, that sounds right. And in the psychoeducation piece, it's the way you explain it is really just understanding our responses and why or why not we would be acting as such.
Yeah. Yes. And I think especially like with staff and parents, too, explaining what a dysregulated nervous system versus a regulated nervous system looks like. Because there's a tendency, I think, when we see someone having a behavior, oh, they're bad. Why are they doing this? They're not bad. Their system is dysregulated. And so I like to use those words because to me, those words aren't as shame based and they're not as judgy. It's simply information. Your nervous system is dysregulated. Okay, now that I know that, we can do strategies to help. And so I think helping parents kind of shift the way that they're looking at those things can also help them in how they respond.
And at what point do you give the psychoeducation? For parents, at any point, but for let's say your client that's an adult or even a kid who's having a response, have you ever tried giving them the psychoeducation during a response, like, look, this is what's happening, or do you have to do it after the fact?
That's a good question. At least with my clientele, I try not to do it in the moment because if they're having a trauma response, a stress response, the prefrontal cortex is offline, and so they're not even necessarily listening
registering.
To what I'm saying. It's kind of just lots of words, and that can actually make stuff worse. So I try to do it after, but I imagine it would also depend on the client. You know, maybe you have a client where you can use very simple terms, or hey, how's our brain working? You know, where that could be effective. But at least for my clients, I try to deal with the body first, get us to a feeling of safety, and then we can like debrief about it.
My second surprise word is fall. Can you take me a little bit into there? How, in the moment, how do you bring them to a safer place?
Yeah, so again, that's going to really depend on like the type of behaviors that you're dealing with. Like, I don't recommend using this if someone is displaying a lot of physical aggression or they're a safety risk or they're trying to run away. You know, in that moment, we're just, you know, we're doing what we need to do to keep you safe. But I'm thinking of some of my clients that maybe have really big feelings, like they're just, you know, crying and crying and crying. So I'm thinking of a client I had, and she was talking about some past abuse that she had experienced. And so she started crying, and then she apologized for crying. And I said, no. I love that you are crying. Crying is so healthy. Crying can actually help us feel better. So please. So the first thing I did was I normalized that feeling for her. And then I just sat in silence with her. And that was really to help her sit with that big feeling and realize that she could sit with that big feeling. And again, it's going to depend on the client. I had another client I tried to do that with, and he could only sit with his feeling for like 3 seconds. And then we had to switch and go to neutral topics of conversation. So I try to do that. I also try to bring in some somatic practices. So I have been taking coursework to be a somatic experiencing professional. And this is, again, another area that I think when you're working with trauma, knowing that somatic piece is huge, but you really, really want to make sure you go and get additional, like, training and certification in it. Because
nervous systems are... Can you tell us a little bit about somatic experiencing?
Yeah. So like I said, I'm still relatively new to it. And I know that there are some BCBAs that maybe have more experience in it because they've done, like, you know, body work or yoga teachers that kind of goes hand in hand. But with somatic experiencing, the focus there is... Your body is stuck in trauma. Your nervous system is dysregulated. So let's do some things to regulate the nervous system. And there's lots of different ways to do it. Some of it is going to be doing very slow movements, kind of pendulating back between maybe talking about the trauma experience and then talking about things that are neutral. So there's definitely a lot that goes into it. And I don't feel like I... know enough speak extensively to it.
I have some questions because it's new to me, like totally new to me. You were saying like you some ways to do it is through like actual real physical movements, and then you also mentioned like through speaking, and then you were just like, you know, go to more like whatever, it's different ways to do it.
Yeah, okay, so one thing that I really like is instead of focusing on feelings and emotion words, let's focus on sensations, because that really is all a feeling or emotion is. What we have done as people is we've added language to sensations. And the problem with language is it often also has baggage associated with it. You know, like talking about how you might feel angry or jealous or ashamed, those words can be really hard to admit and can actually sometimes even increase the behavior. You know, I'm thinking of my clients yelling, "I'm not mad." And I'm like, "You obviously are mad, but I know it's hard to admit to that feeling." And so I like to focus more on just the sensations. So going back to my client that was crying, I always ask permission first. I said, "Hey, what would it be like if you were to describe where in your body you feel that sadness?" And she was able to say, "Well, I feel it in my heart." And I said, "Okay, well, tell me a little bit more about that. Is it slow? Is it fast? Is it big? Is it small? If it were a color, if your feeling was a color, what color would it be? Can you show me the size? How big does that sad feel right now?" So we're taking away some of those judgments and we're focusing on neutral sensation words. And then what I love about that is, in general, a sensation isn't going to hurt you, right? Like if I'm feeling anxious and my heart is beating really fast, it's not comfortable, but it's not going to kill me. It's just an uncomfortable feeling. And we can sit with uncomfortable sensations. It takes time to build that capacity, but we can start doing that really small with our clients. So, you know, neutralizing the feeling, taking away some of the feeling words, focusing on sensations, focusing on sitting with those sensations. That's kind of the goal there.
You said that so well. Like, I was even just thinking, specifically because you used the word anxiety. Like, whenever a person, like, hears the word anxiety, they automatically go into, like, oh my gosh, having a person could feel. Having an anxiety attack, I'm having anxiety. And then all of a sudden, like, they have an anxiety attack. They're talking themselves into it. But when you say, like, take away the word anxiety, anxiety is very provoking because there's so much involved. Then it's like, it's just the beating of my chest. That's it. And then it could cut, I would assume it like stops there because like that's what it is. Why would it go elsewhere?
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah. And like even moving a step further is kind of tracking that. So, so I actually do this myself to help me sleep at night. So I get really anxious at night. And so I sit there and I notice that my heart is beating really fast. And so I mentally tell myself, okay, I'm just going to sit and I'm going to notice this. And I just list the sensations. Oh, I'm noticing pounding. I'm noticing fast. And I'll sit with it and then I'll label how it changes, because it will. Our sensations and our feelings are like a wave. And I explain this to my clients too. Something that feels big right now may not feel big in a minute or two. And that sometimes makes it easier to sit with the uncomfortable feelings. Anyway, sorry, going back. So then I track it and I notice, oh, well, the sensation in my heart is gone, but I'm noticing maybe some warmth in my hands. And so then I focus on the warmth in my hands. And then I might notice, oh, well, I just felt something in my throat. So you can sit with that uncomfortable sensation and then notice that it's going to change in your body and might go to neutral and pleasant sensations, which are also good to sit with.
It's amazing. It really, like, it's something that, like, so true. Like, oh yeah, of course, sensations, feelings. But when you really, like, think of it as this and you, like, practice it for real, then it's game-changing. It really is.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
I had a client, and he uses a letter board to communicate, and we do all of this stuff virtually. And he feels a lot of shame around his autism and talks quite extensively about that. And I was so proud of him because we were able to practice some of these things. So first I was asking him how he was feeling because I was noticing a lot of, you know, movement. And, you know, I know I just said I like to focus on sensations, but it helps, at least with him. He doesn't have the sensation language yet. He is still very focused on feelings because that's what we teach, right? Like from a young age, I'm feeling happy, I'm feeling sad. Sensation words don't always come. So with him, I start off with the feeling word and then move him into sensations. So he said that he was feeling anxiety and happiness. And I said, well, I love that you notice you can feel both, right? You can feel both feelings. And then we talked about, I started with the easy one and I said, hey, if you were to describe your happy feeling as a color, you know, what color would it be? And he was able to describe that and the size and where he felt it. And then I said, hey, how do you feel or can I ask you what your anxiety feels like? And I always give them an out. You know, I said, if you don't want to do this, you tell me no. And he said, no, I want to do it. And so he was able to describe his anxiety as a color. I think he said it was purple. I think he said his anxiety was purple. And he was not able to show me the size, but I think he said that it felt medium. And so I provided just a lot of reassuring statements about, hey, that is really cool that you're sitting with that. And then we checked in after 3 seconds. Tell me about the size now. Did it stay the same? Did it change? You know, and I think he said it went down. I can't remember. But then that leads into, hey, that's really cool that you sat with a sensation that maybe didn't feel great, but you were brave enough to do it. And the size of the feeling has changed. You know, and so really helping our clients see those moments when they're brave because they're feeling difficult feelings.
That's amazing. And I guess that's like a big, this is like a huge piece in psychoeducation, and I'm really understanding what they're feeling, how it affects them, and then how to deal with it. And you can't deal with something that you don't really understand. So by them just really understanding what's going on, does it come like second nature? Like, our bodies really know what to do and how to take care of ourselves. So if we, as soon as we like identify it, does things happen on its own of just like things settling down? Is that what you see?
Yeah, it's interesting that you say that the body knows what it needs, because it does. What the problem is that as society, we have expectations about ways that you should and shouldn't act, or, you know, things that you should and shouldn't do. And so I'm thinking of a time when I was actually practicing somatic experiencing with another person. So I was doing the sessions myself. I was feeling a lot of anxiety about things. And so we had talked about, you know, what that felt like in my body. And then the practitioner said, well, what does your body feel like it has to do right now? And that was such an interesting question. I was like, oh my God, I don't even know what, what does my body want right now? And I realized, and I've been doing this more and more, it needed a loving gesture. So it needed me to put both hands on my heart and just kind of push a little bit. And it was so interesting because it wasn't planned. It just, I don't know, that's what my body felt like it needed. And so I think if we give people chances to explore that, what does your body need? If you had to make a movement right now, what does your body feel like it wants to do? Like you said, the body knows what it needs, but I think it's people and humans and society that stifles that a little bit. And we forget to pay attention to our feelings. And a big part of that is interoception, which you're going to see a lot of in like the occupational therapy world. And I would recommend getting more training in that too, because a lot of our clients don't have great interoceptive skills. And so that means that they're not always able, like I said, to list the sensations of what they're feeling. And so, you know, kind of looking at where your client is with that too.
Yeah. Saying, yeah, we have to trust ourselves a little bit more and get rid of, like you said, like baggage with feelings. But like, you know, there's no one right way to do things. You just got to trust yourself and do what you need to do. So that is a huge, huge piece. And I would think that most BCBAs are not like you in a sense where like you think you need to know more, so you go for that training. So here I'm going to ask you, how do you make sure to stay in the scope of practice? Like you even said, like you didn't want to talk about something. You didn't feel like you were there. It's very honest and good. But if a person does take one or two CEUs, they feel really, you know, that they got this, wow, so cool, I can understand this. How much could I work on it as a BCBA without being like thoroughly trained? And at what point do you say like, okay, let's bring a mental health specialist into this. I don't have the training for it. My third surprise word is kind.
Yeah, so the first thing that I do with my parents and clients is explain that I'm not a talk therapist. And part of that could be how I refer to myself. If I say to my clients or the parents I work with, oh, hey, I'm a board certified behavior analyst, to a lot of them that feels really stuffy and I can see like reactions. And so I just changed and I call myself a behavior therapist. But the problem is when people hear therapist, they tend to think like, oh, talk therapy or processing family issues. And so I do a lot of front loading about, hey, I know that you're seeing the word therapist there, but when it comes to talk therapy, processing things verbally, those aren't things that I can do. So I like to always just offer that up front so they can also make an informed decision if they feel they need to, you know, get more support. So what I tell myself is I can teach people about their bodies. I can teach people about their nervous systems because I've gone and gotten those CEUs, right? But when it comes to processing trauma or processing memories or talking extensively about problems, that's not necessarily something I can fix. And if a client comes to me and they want to talk about it, I'm not going to stop them, because I think that can be beneficial sometimes, talking about it. But that's also not my role. So yeah, that's what I kind of tell myself, is anytime we get into more complex things that involve like past trauma, relationships that were difficult. And I think also anytime we're going to diagnose or try to diagnose, you know, we obviously can't do that. So I was doing a lot of reading and research in the area of grief and people with disabilities. And it was interesting because there's a lot of talk about complicated grief. And so I was making a CEU about it. And I thought, you know, it's good, I think, for BCBAs to know, oh, hey, this is what the DSM says about this, or this is what the DM says about this, just so you can kind of mentally know. And we can then talk about behaviors that we see, but making sure that we're not the ones that are, you know, diagnosing anything like that.
Okay. Basically, by staying in scope of what we can do and not taking it further or making like decisions that are big in that sense.
Yeah. Yeah. And I feel like I didn't give like a super clear answer, because I was even trying to like label it out. Like, when would I go to a licensed professional counselor? I also feel like I tend to err on the side of caution a lot. And so I involve lots of people from different, different walks of life, or, you know, different educational backgrounds, just because I think, I want to make sure that I'm not doing harm. And so I might do a little too much in that area, but that's me.
I don't think it's ever too much, you know, like even to just get a second opinion, like, hey, like, this is what I'm dealing with. Do you think I can? Or if a person's not sure, usually a person will know, like, can I do this? Can I not? But if you're not sure, to just get a second opinion is always a better option.
Yeah. And I will say, like, the number of times that I've gone to Camille Kolu and said, I just have a really quick question. I mean, she will answer almost, immediately. And so there are really good BCBAs out there that I think are, you know, willing to help provide support and even just a little free consult before you get deep into things. So definitely, you know, reach out to other BCBAs.
Amazing. You said so much about, from trauma-informed to that, really being practical, identifying it, bringing in the psychoeducation part, what somatic experiencing is to help the psychoeducation to really get a good feel. Is there anything else you want to bring in that you feel like is a very important piece to this whole trauma-informed in ABA?
Yeah. And I think you kind of touched on this in the very beginning. It's about being humble. I think that when we're humble and we're willing to ask questions and we're willing to sit with people in difficult moments, like, I think that that's huge. I think back to some of the somatic experiencing stuff that I've done, and one of the biggest things that I've learned with that is being able to sit with discomfort. Because when I have a client crying, it's very natural for us to want to comfort them, because we don't like seeing them crying. It makes us feel like we're not doing a good job, or why are you sad, or don't be sad. When really the best thing that you can do with someone, the most compassionate thing you can do with someone, is just sit with them when they have their big feelings and just be that support.
That's amazing. Thank you so much, Trisha. There's so many takeaways to this. I learned so much. I was just taking everything in, and I hope everyone does too. So thank you so much for joining me.
Yeah, thank you.
This was amazing. I loved it.